As the war raged in the East, the white frontier exploded into its own nightmare of killing. The outbreaks had their origins in the North in 1862 with an Indian revolt on the prairie plains of Minnesota. That year, the Santee Sioux, the Eastern Sioux, also known as Dakota, rose up in rebellion from their reservation along the Minnesota River. They killed as many as 800 white settlers, the highest civilian wartime toll in U.S. history prior to 9/11. They made another 40,000 into refugees, who fled eastward in full mortal panic. The violence was extreme, almost mindless, spurred in part by the failure of the federal government to deliver annuities and supplies, and in part by the absence of government troops. Unlike the Texans, most of whom came from pioneer stock and understood the atrocities of Indian and especially Comanche warfare, these Minnesotans were simple yeoman farmers. Most were from Europe. Their reaction was hysterical fear, which only became worse when they experienced what the northern settlers had not yet encountered, the calculated rape and torture of female captives. When Bluecoat volunteers finally crushed the Santee Rebellion, angry mobs screamed at the captives in their cages, castrated the few they got a hold of, and demanded that the rebels be executed. If President Lincoln had not stepped in, hundreds would have died that way. As it was, 38 were hanged, the largest one-day execution in American history. The following year, the tribe was expelled from Minnesota, their reservations abolished. At long last, the Sioux, the great power of the North, were finally colliding with the advancing line of settlements, something that had been happening in Texas since the 1820s. By late 1863, it had become clear to most of the free-ranging horse tribes on the southern plains that there were no soldiers to stop them. By the summer of 1864, they were riding roughshod into the settlements from Colorado to South Texas, attacking pioneers and soldiers alike recklessly and with little fear of retribution. Huge stretches of land that had been settled as far back as the 1850s became completely depopulated. Comanche attacks virtually shut down the Santa Fe Trail. The overland mail abandoned its stations for 400 miles. Emigration stopped. Cheyenne raids cut off supplies to the Colorado mining camps, where people were starving. The price of a bag of flour in the isolated town of Denver reached $45. The frontier again rolled backward, in some places between 100 and 200 miles, canceling two decades of Western progress. For a brief and terrifying moment, the raids appeared to have stalled the very idea that undergirded America's westward boom. Manifest destiny only worked, after all, if you could conquer and subdue the nation's midsection. One of the best examples of this new, untrammeled violence was the Elm Creek Raid. In October 1864, a force of 700 Comanches and Kiowa warriors and 300 assorted other women, children, and old men under the Comanche chief Little Buffalo rode out from their camp at Red Bluff on the Canadian River. The expedition, the largest mounted to date by these two tribes, crossed the Red River 10 miles above Fort Belknap, then attacked a settlement consisting of 60 houses in the creek bottoms just south of the Red. There was nothing to stop them. No fear of rangers or federal forces, no commanders like Hayes or Ford to pursue them. Unlike the Santee Sioux, they were still nomads and thus could hide anywhere on the Great Plains. They burned and killed, stole cattle and horses, and forced a group of terrified settlers to retreat into a small stockade called Fort Murrah. At this point, the cavalry arrived, though it did not save the day. Quite the contrary. Riding briskly out of Fort Belknap, 14 state militiamen ran headlong into a swirling body of 300 mounted warriors. Five of these soldiers died instantly, and several others were wounded. The rest fled for their lives, some riding double on their horses, most of which had been pincushioned with arrows and were bleeding profusely. They took shelter at Fort Murrah, and there they cowered with the others, refusing to ride for help. In their place went several less intimidated settlers who barely made it with their lives. By the time help arrived, the Indians had lost interest and departed. The tally? 11 settlers and 5 soldiers killed, 7 women and children carried off. The perpetrators were not pursued. This sort of raid was duplicated all along the frontier that year. Like many others against the militias, it was not a fair fight. Such violence called for retribution. In late 1864, Brigadier General James H. Carleton, the ranking U.S. Army officer in the territory of New Mexico, decided to do something about the problem. Carleton was a button-down New Englander, a prig, and a stubborn know-it-all with a large ego and a startling range of talents that included mountain climbing, seed collecting, waltzing, archaeology, military history, boat design, and the study of meteorites. He was deeply offended by the impunity with which the Comanches were attacking his territory. Early that year, he and the legendary scout Colonel Christopher Kit Carson had conducted a massive campaign against the Navajos in New Mexico, finally cornering them in the Canyon de Chelly, destroying their crops and seizing their stock, and forcing 8,000 of them onto a reservation. Unfortunately for Carleton, the Navajo reservation happened to be located on the margins of Comancheria. It was not long before the Western Comanche bands figured out how exquisitely vulnerable their old enemies were in their new location. The Nemeneux swooped down in early morning raids, attacking Navajo villages, stealing sheep, horses, women, and children, and generally ruining Carleton's well-laid plans. Carleton was further infuriated by the relentless Comanche attacks on army supply caravans on the Santa Fe Trail. These wagon trains contained both the food that would ensure the Navajos' survival and the communications that served as the general's only contact with his colleagues in the East. Carleton had been, in fact, isolated. From where he sat in his Santa Fe office, everything to the east of him seemed chaos and destruction. In November 1864, he dispatched Colonel Carson on a punitive expedition into the most remote and historically inviolable part of the Comanche heartland, the 3,500-foot-high country in the Texas Panhandle, distinguished by its flat, oceanic expanses of grass that were broken by jagged rock canyons, cut by ancient rivers, and inhabited by the fiercest and most remote Comanche bands, and pierced only by the Comanchero traders out of New Mexico. Only a few white men had ever been there before, mostly traders. And no Texan, ranger or otherwise, had ever had the courage to track Comanches onto the Llano Estacado. That had long been considered certain death. Either the trackless, waterless plains would get you, or the Comanches would. It was quite a brave thing for mounted soldiers to cross the Red River, to ascend the austerely beautiful Wichita Mountains in pursuit of the raiders. Launching oneself onto the wide-open high plains was more like suicide. Oddly enough, the Comanches, who had heard about Carleton's plan through Comanchero traders, had tried to arrange a truce. A group of 10 Comanches and Kiowas, led by the Yamparica chief Ten Bears, Perua Semina, had traveled to Fort Bascom in eastern New Mexico for that purpose. But Carleton had ordered the fort's commander to tell them, in no uncertain terms, that they need not come in with any more white flags until they are willing to give up the stock they have stolen this year from our people, and also the men among them who have killed our people without provocation or cause. The campaign would move forward. Perilous though it was, if there was one man in the country who could actually lead such an expedition, that man was Kit Carson. Carson was one of the most storied figures in the American West, celebrated in dime Blood and Thunder novels even while he was alive. He was a trapper, hunter, and wilderness scout, and one of the first white men to explore the wild lands beyond the 100th meridian. He served as guide for John C. Fremont's famous expeditions into the Trans Mountain West between 1842 and 1846, and became a national hero through Fremont's published reports. Diminutive, taciturn, barely literate, and unimpressive personally, he was nonetheless a dominant figure on the western frontier. He had married several Indian wives, was fluent in a number of Indian languages, and had served as Indian agent in New Mexico. He was also a successful Indian fighter, having led effective campaigns against the Navajo and the Mescalero Apaches. He had done battle with Comanches in small engagements over the years. He knew what he was doing. On November 12, 1864, 4 days after Abraham Lincoln was re-elected president, and the day after William Tecumseh Sherman burned Atlanta, Carson rode out of his camp on the plains of eastern New Mexico with 14 officers, 321 enlisted men, and a screen of 72 Apache and Ute scouts. The latter were bitter traditional enemies of the Comanches, and they were not frightened, as most white men were, by the appalling emptiness of the Buffalo Plains. Carson, moreover, did not have to pay them. He simply promised them all the plunder and Comanche scalps they could carry away. Like other white commanders of Indian scouts, he would simply have to live with and try to rein in their worst tendencies, which involved torture and rape and wanton killing of non-combatants and other deeds the whites found distasteful. In principle, anyway. The Utes and Apaches also drove the white soldiers to distraction with their war dances, howlingly loud, raucous affairs that often lasted nearly until dawn. The expedition left in the late fall. That was when the Indians, who tended to rove in fragmented and widely dispersed groups during the spring and summer, headed for their winter camps, where they concentrated in villages whose sun-bleached buffalo hide teepees snaked for miles along a few favorite streams. Carleton believed that the Comanches and Kiowas were camped on the Canadian River in the northern part of the Texas Panhandle. That was Confederate territory, of course, though nothing could have been less likely than an encounter with rebel militias on the high and wild plains. Carson's troops moved eastward through the thin, frosty air, riding through the horizon-spanning, horse-high grass behind their screens of Indian scouts. By now, it had become so common to find Kiowas and Comanches camping, hunting, and raiding together that their relationship as fellow travelers deserves a note of explanation. Though it is hard to say exactly why the two tribes had such a deep affinity for each other, they did share common traits. Like the Comanches, the Kiowas had migrated in the 17th century from the mountain north down to the buffalo-rich southern plains. Both tribes had found extraordinary power in the horse. Both were exceptional horsemen, even on the plains, where all tribes were excellent riders, and both were exceptionally warlike, even by the brutal martial standards of the plains. They had fought each other for years and had made a single definitive peace in 1790. There were differences, too. Instead of the Nemeneux's practical, minimalist culture, the Kiowas had elaborate and hierarchical military societies, a rich tradition of art that produced sophisticated pictographs and elaborate chronological calendars, and a far more complex religious mythology that featured a sun dance. What they were not was numerous, and that made perhaps the biggest difference. They never exercised a raw power of numbers that the Comanche tribe did. The Kiowas and their sub-band the Kiowa or Plains Apaches, a very small Athapascan-speaking tribe, never numbered more than 1,800, a small fraction of Comanche strength at its apogee. After a 12-day ride, Carson's scouts finally spotted Comanche and Kiowa lodges just south of the present town of Borger, Texas. That night, the men rode silently and in darkness down into the Canadian River Valley under strict orders not to talk or smoke. They dismounted and stood shivering in heavy frost and holding their horses by their bridle reins until the first gray streaks of dawn appeared in the eastern skies. They moved forward at daylight, fronted by their Indian scouts, and dragging with them two mountain howitzers, which they had considerable trouble lugging through the tall brown grass and the driftwood along the banks of the Canadian. These were not incidental pieces of equipment. The howitzers looked like foreshortened, downsized cannon. They were short-barreled, large-caliber guns with big-spoked wheels that fired 12-pound payloads. Their advantage was that they were extremely mobile. They also packed a nasty wallop, especially when used against crowds of people. They fired two main types of ammo, spherical case shot and canister. Spherical case shot consisted of a single round iron shell filled with 82 musket balls packed in sulfur with a small bursting charge of gunpowder. Canister turned the howitzer into the equivalent of a giant sawed-off shotgun, spewing 148 .69-caliber lead musket balls with every shot. The weapons had seen limited use against Indians, notably in the 1862 campaign against the Santee Sioux in Minnesota. No one among Carson's troops knew, as they cursed and dragged the homely little cannon through the tall grass, that the guns would mean the difference between life and death, victory and defeat for the expedition. At around 8:30 in the morning, on a brilliantly clear and cloudless day, Carson's advance swept into a Kiowa village of 176 lodges. They surprised the Indians, who fought desperately to cover the retreat of their women and children, then fled downriver themselves. There were only a few casualties in this skirmish, among them four blind and crippled old Kiowas who had had their heads cloven with axes wielded by Ute women, who had been brought along, it seems, to help their mates commit what whites might have considered war atrocities. Meanwhile, Carson's main force pressed onward toward the much larger Comanche camp, which was located 4 miles ahead, finally stopping at the ruins of a trading post known throughout the frontier as Adobe Walls. And it was here, around 10 a.m., that they engaged some 1,600 Comanches and Kiowas. The battle did not last long. The howitzers, which had been dragged to the top of a symmetrical, cone-shaped, 30-foot-high hill nearby, were loaded and fired. Almost instantly, the Comanches and Kiowas, who had been charging furiously along the battle line, stopped, stood high on their stirrups, and watched as the case shot exploded, and then exploded again. No weapon like this had ever been seen on the high plains. The Indians soon had a name for it, the gun that shot twice. In the account of Captain George Pettis, who was with Carson at Adobe Walls, the hostiles gazed for a single moment with astonishment, then guiding their horses' heads away from us and giving one concerted, prolonged yell, they started in a dead run for their village. When the fourth shot was fired, there was not a single enemy within the extreme range of the howitzers. Instead of pursuing the fleeing Indians, however, the white men now decided to take a break. Carson's orders might seem perplexing, but his men had been fighting or marching for 30 hours. They relaxed and ate whatever hardtack or raw bacon or salt pork they had stuffed away in their haversacks, drank from what Pettis described as fine a running brook of clear cold water as I ever saw on the frontiers, and told stories of the day's heroics. Their horses grazed peacefully in the lush, uncropped grasses. Carson's plan was that, after their rest, the men would mount up and move against the Comanche villages and destroy them. This seemed reasonable enough, but as would soon be apparent, it was actually a setup for the sort of slaughter that would take place 12 years later at the Little Bighorn. Less than half an hour had elapsed when the Indians began again to mass on the open ground in front of the old adobe ruins, and again the soldiers heard the sharp, quick whiz of the Indians' rifle balls. They also heard something very strange, a bugle blaring periodically from the enemy's ranks, blowing the opposite of whatever the army bugler blew. If the federal bugle sounded advance, he would blow retreat, and so on. The Indian bugler was every bit as good as the white buglers, and each time he blew, the soldiers would erupt into laughter, in spite of themselves. The battle resumed at full intensity, and it soon became clear that the Comanches and Kiowas had figured out at least some of the deadly anti-personnel characteristics of the howitzers. The chiefs spread their warriors out. Their policy was to act singly, wrote Pettis, and avoid getting into masses. The tactic worked, and the howitzers were only fired a few times. On one of those occasions, the shell passed directly through the body of a horse on which was a Comanche riding at a full run, and went some 200 or 300 yards further on before it exploded. The horse, on being struck, went headforemost to earth, throwing his rider, as it seemed, 20 feet into the air, with his hands and feet sprawling in all directions. The Indians, meanwhile, had mounted a furious attack. Numbers of them had dismounted and were laying down a withering fire from the high grass, while a buzzing horde of riders swooped along the front, firing their rifles from beneath their horses' necks. Something else was happening, too, as the battle raged into mid-afternoon, that Carson and his officers could not help noticing. This was the arrival of more and more warriors from the large Comanche village that lay visible downstream on the Canadian River. They came up steadily, in groups of 50 or more. At some point, probably around 3 o'clock, Pettus estimated that Colonel Carson's modest 2nd Cavalry was facing an Indian cohort of 3,000, under the command of legendary Ten Bears, the principal Yamparica Band chief of the 1860s, and a man who had actually been to Washington in 1863 and received a peace medal. Kiowa Chief Tohausen also figured prominently in the battle. Though Pettus's estimate of enemy force is undoubtedly high, that number would have accounted for most of the Comanche and Kiowa warriors in existence in 1864, the soldiers now began to fear for their own safety. Their supply train, for one thing, was guarded by a mere 75 men, and Carson could see large numbers of Indians begin to stream toward his rear. It was to Carson's credit that at 3:30 p.m., having engaged the Indians for the better part of 5 hours, he gave the order to fall back. Though his decision was vigorously opposed by most of his officers, who believed their troops should move forward and take the village before them, the Ute and Apache leaders advocated retreat. Carson listened to the Indians. He sent skirmishers out in his front, rear, and on both flanks, and very carefully made his return march, while the Indians continued to attack him on all sides. His idea was to return to the smaller Kiowa village, burn it, then move out. His force reached that village just before sundown. It was full of Indians. Carson was now surrounded by the full Indian force, which meant 10-to-1 odds. He ought not to have survived, any more than Custer survived his own deadly and not entirely dissimilar blunder years later. That he did is entirely due to the lethal little howitzers. Carson ordered them dragged to the top of a small sandhill near the Kiowa village. And now they boomed forth case and canister, driving the Indians back out of the village and allowing the whites in. They plundered it. The lodges were full of coveted buffalo robes, and then burned it down, while the deadly case shot sung through the twilight air. One round hit squarely amid some 30 to 40 Indian riders. Darkness fell, and the retreat continued. The Indians followed Carson's men for a while and scared them into riding almost continuously for 4 days, but they did not ever renew their attack. They had just fought and finished one of the largest battles ever fought on the Great Plains. The version of the Battle of Adobe Walls that went into the military records was noteworthy for its complete inaccuracy. The report stated that Carson and his force attacked a Kiowa village of about 150 lodges near the Adobe Fort on the Canadian River in Texas, and after a severe fight, compelled the Indians to retreat, with a loss of 60 killed and wounded. Estimates were of 30 killed and 30 wounded. Carson had not beaten anyone. He had narrowly avoided the massacre of his own troops, as he himself conceded on more than one occasion. Without the howitzers, few would have been left alive to tell the tale, he said later. His own losses were not inconsequential. 7 dead, 6 whites and 1 Indian, and 21 wounded, 17 whites and 4 Indians. He had retreated under cover of darkness. Captain Pettus later spoke with a Mexican trader who was at the Comanche camp at the time of the battle. Wrote Pettus, "The Indians claimed that if the whites had not had with them the guns that shoot twice," referring to the shells of the mountain howitzers, "they would never have allowed a single white man to escape out of the valley of the Canadian. And I may say, without becoming immodest, that this was often the expressed opinion of Colonel Carson." Carson's was not the only punitive expedition launched in 1864. 4 days later, and several hundred miles to the north, a former Methodist preacher turned territorial officer named J.M. Chivington presided over the bloodiest, most treacherous, and least justified slaughter of Indians in American history. It would pass into legend and infamy under the name of the Sand Creek Massacre. Cheyennes were the victims. Chivington was a product of his times. A tall, imposing man with a barrel chest and a thick neck, he had spent much of his time setting up Sunday schools in the Colorado mining camps. In the personnel vacuum left by the onset of war in the East, he had risen like other incompetents to the position of Brigadier General in the U.S. Army, commanding a large, unreliable, often drunk gang of second-rate soldiers who constituted the Territorial Volunteers in Colorado. The Cheyenne and Comanche attacks of the summer and fall had created a feeling of grim panic in the streets of Denver. Citizens were desperate, sometimes hysterical. Everyone knew someone who had been attacked or killed. Whatever sympathy the horse tribes may once have inspired was gone. The idea now was to annihilate them, both in retribution for what they had done and to prevent future attacks. Chivington was their champion, and he believed God was on his side. "Damn any man who sympathizes with the Indians," he said. "I have come to kill Indians, and I believe it is right and honorable to use any means under God's heaven to kill Indians." To encourage recruitment into the volunteer units, he displayed the mutilated corpses of a white family of four next to the enlistment table. He spoke enthusiastically of taking scalps and wading in gore. His instructions to his men, which later became famous, were unambiguous. "Kill and scalp all, big and little. Nits make lice." At 8 o'clock in the evening of November 28, 1864, under a starry winter sky, Chivington and 700 territorial troops advanced from Fort Lyon in the Colorado Territory, riding in columns of fours. The next morning, they attacked the Cheyenne village of Chief Black Kettle, a village that had just made a truce with the white soldiers. But Chivington's purpose was only to kill Indians, and that is what he did. He began by pounding the lodges with the fragmenting shells from four mountain howitzers. And then his men streamed in, many drunk or hungover from the night's drinking, slashing and shooting indiscriminately. At the time of the attack, there were some 600 Cheyennes in the camp. Of these, no more than 35 were warriors. Most of the men were out hunting buffalo. There is little point in describing what happened in detail. Children were shot, point blank. Babies were bayoneted. Saddest of all was the sight of the Indians huddling around a large American flag that had been draped over Black Kettle's teepee. They gathered and flew white flags, and the women opened their shirts so there could be no mistaking their sex, and waited patiently for the soldiers to see that the Indians were friendly and stop the killing. Instead, they were cut down. When the smoke had cleared and the screaming had stopped, 300 Cheyennes lay dead. All were scalped, and many were mutilated. One man had cut out a woman's private parts and exhibited them on a stick. The massacre quickly became public, mainly because a number of Chivington soldiers were disgusted by what had happened and later told their story to the press, but also because many of the victors had not been shy of bragging about what they had done, of which they were proud, initially at least. Chivington's return to Denver, in fact, was triumphant, the newspapers full of stories praising him. Chivington himself proclaimed that, "Posterity will speak of me as the great Indian fighter. I have eclipsed Kit Carson." Carson responded, "Just to think of that dog Chivington and his dirty hounds up thar at Sand Creek. His men shot down squaws and blew the brains out of innocent children. You call sich soldiers Christians, do ye?" At a theater in town, the Colorado troopers had displayed their trophies for cheering crowds. Tobacco pouches made from scrotums, fingers, scalps, purses made from pudenda cut from Comanche women. As the details became known, A wave of revulsion swept through the corridors of power and influence in New York, Philadelphia, and Washington. The Sand Creek Massacre would have an enormous and lasting effect on the Indian policy that was made in those places, which would largely determine the fate of the Plains tribes over the next decade. It is interesting to note, though, that such gut-churning shame and disgust was largely confined to the East. The protest over the killing of women was not echoed by any such sentiments in Indian country, where everyone knew that women were often combatants. They were not in this case. Nor was there any outcry on the frontier over the use of mountain howitzers against a sleeping village, as there was in the East. What Chivington had done was what many people in the West, including the regular army, believed had to be done. The army's distaste for Chivington had more to do with style and with the savagery of his raw recruits. He had, after all, attacked a village under truce. Otherwise, it was clear from the reaction on the raw frontier that it was long past the time when it had become morally justifiable to kill Indian women and children. 15. Peace and Other Horrors. The end of the Civil War in the spring of 1865 and the collapse of the Confederacy brought final and complete chaos to the frontier. Before, there had been at least a pretense of organization. Now, there was nothing. The militias disappeared from the federal lands. For a period of months, there could be said to be no government at all in Texas, no systems, no authority, no power. It must have seemed to the people that the good old days had returned, that the Great Father's War had done something strange and permanent and magical to remove their old enemies from the borderlands. The Comanche numbers were still small. There were only, we must remind ourselves, maybe 4,000 of them out there holding up the advance of Western civilization, but a good deal of their old power had come back, and with it had come the old arrogance. Their social organization was still based on warrior status. There was, indeed, no other form of social advancement. Their wealth still consisted of stolen horseflesh, and now, once again, they had the unfettered ability to make splendid war throughout the borderlands, both on whites and Indians. The weird time warp persisted. As teenagers, Quanta and his peers were living, hunting, and raiding just as their fathers and grandfathers had done, as though hundreds of thousands of white people were not poised to rush headlong into Comanche lands at the first sign of weakness or opportunity. The tribe had a thriving new business, too, to add to selling stolen horses and captives, cattle thieving. These years had been the beginning of the great cattle operations in Texas. In the West, the Quahadis had transformed themselves into a sort of bovine clearinghouse. They stole cattle from Texas. Charles Goodnight put the number rustled during the Civil War years at an astonishing 300,000 head, and traded them through Comancheros to government contractors in New Mexico, who sold them to the U.S. Army. General Carleton, to be precise. In some cases, they were actually selling Carleton back his own cattle. In exchange, the Comanches received the guns and ammunition, increasingly revolvers and high-quality carbines, that had been deployed against Kit Carson at Adobe Walls. The business was so good that some wealthy Anglo-Americans got into it, furnishing capital to the Mexican traders. Carleton knew all about this ingenious commercial two-step, and it made him furious. What had happened was that the state and territorial militias, the core of frontier defense for 4 years, had simply melted away. In the Confederacy, they were forcibly disbanded. But they disappeared in Union areas as well. There were political and organizational reasons for this. During the war, large numbers of volunteers had been raised under the government's emergency powers. These were the troops under the command of Carson and Chivington. With the end of the war, few wanted to remain on permanent duty, and thus most of them were now released. The U.S. military, meanwhile, was undergoing a rapid downsizing that by 1866 would draw the total number of troops down to 75,000, and the 8,000 regulars that Ulysses S. Grant sent to Texas as an army of occupation were entirely concerned with affairs other than fighting Indians. When the governor of Texas later tried to fill this military void with state troops, the federal government refused to allow it. Demilitarizing the South was a priority of the Reconstruction era, and Washington was not going to permit rebellious Texas to raise its own armies again. Nor was Congress, groaning under an enormous war debt, inclined to spend money on costly campaigns against a relatively small group of savages who posed no direct threat to the nation. There was something else, too, that contributed to this lack of will to stop Indian raiding on the western frontier. This was the particular and very strong belief shared by many people in the civilized East that the Indian wars were principally the fault of white men. The governing idea was that the Comanches and other troublesome tribes would live in peace if only they were treated properly, and the farther its devotees were from the bleeding frontier, the more devoutly they believed it. This was the old fight between the army, who knew better, and the Rosewater Dreamers in the Indian Office, who called their uniformed adversaries butchers, sots determined to exterminate the noble red men and foment wars so they had employment. As General John Pope later observed, the army found itself in a no-win position. If successful, it is a massacre of Indians. If unsuccessful, it is worthlessness or imbecility. And these judgments confront the army in every newspaper and in public speeches in Congress and elsewhere, judgments by men who are absolutely ignorant of the subject. Reports of Chivington's massacre and white atrocities in Minnesota seem to prove what the army's critics were saying. The notion that the trouble with Plains Indians was entirely due to white men was spectacularly wrong-headed. The people who cherished it, many of whom were in the U.S. Congress, the Office of Indian Affairs, and other positions of power, had no historical understanding of the Comanche tribe, no idea that the tribe's very existence was based on war and had been for a long time. No one who knew anything about the century-long horror of Comanche attacks in northern Mexico, or about their systematic demolition of the Apaches, or the Utes, or the Tonkawas, could possibly have believed that the tribe was either peaceable or blameless. Except in the larger sense, of course. The Comanches had been first on that land, if that counted for anything, and the westering Anglo-Europeans were the clear aggressors. If the Taibos agreed to stop the advance of their civilization precisely at the 98th meridian and kept their western settlements bottled up beyond the Rockies and refused to build transcontinental railroads or permit pioneers to cross the plains on the Santa Fe and Oregon trails, then a lasting peace might have been made with the Comanches. But these same Indian advocates would never have denied the fundamental right of white Americans to fully possess their continent. Such beatific urges toward peace, combined with relentless and brutal raiding by Comanches in Texas and the Indian Territory, led to the last and most comprehensive treaty ever signed by the Indians of the Southern Plains. The conference that spawned it took place in October 1867 at a campground where the Kiowas held medicine dances, about 75 miles southwest of the present site of Wichita, Kansas. The place was known as Medicine Lodge Creek.